Today's show is going to be about all the crazy things going on in the economy today. Maybe we should call this one Wackadoo Wednesday. So break out your tinfoil hat, because that's what we're going to talk about next.
You're about to hear the opinions, suggestions, and observations of a licensed real estate broker in California. Since each situation can be unique, do not consider anything said here as legal advice for your specific needs. Always seek out the advice of a suitable professional in your area for advice tailored to your situation. Please remember that when following advice, your results may vary. Please also understand that the information provided here is not intended to cover all aspects of the subject material, but rather a sample of issues the speaker considers important.
You seem to understand. I'm not locked in here with you. You're locked in here with me!
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Real Estate Realities with the Rebel Broker. My name's Robert Whitelaw, and I am the Rebel Broker. Licensed real estate broker in the state of California, a member of the National Association of Realtors. But please, please, don't hold that against me. Another day, another show. It's going to be an interesting one, folks. I was just sort of making my way through another hump day and decided it was time to dip my toes into the scary, scary waters of Zero Hedge, where no good news can go untainted. But you know what's scary is, these guys have called it before. So if you're ready for today's show, bust out the tinfoil hat, because I know a lot of folks point to these guys and talk about conspiracy theories or categorize them as just the dudes who want to see everything in a negative light, regardless of anything else. But because they've been right enough of the time, I think they're worth our time. We're going to talk about a variety of articles. I sort of always put these guys off into a queue by themselves. I don't usually consume this one in with my other mainstream news. Maybe I should. I don't know. Maybe it would add an interesting sort of tint or flavor to the other news that I consume. What I do find interesting, though, is when I do go to these sites like this, and there's one other site. What's the name of the other place I go? It's Zero Hedge, and there's one other that always tends to be just a little bit more like this. Let's see here. Calculated Risk, is that the other one? Anyway, unimportant, because I'll share with you whatever I find as I find it. But what's interesting, though, is I will oftentimes find that we go through the process of looking at other news items. We share them here on the show. We try to get information out of them in terms of, well, what do we do with it, right? Now that we've heard this and maybe we're reasonably confident that this information is correct, how do we use it? How do buyers, sellers, investors, or folks chasing down the success use this information to their benefit? And we'll form opinions, and we'll come to conclusions, and we'll look at some of the rah-rah-rah crowd, right? Because it's just the thing that's creepy is, while you can call these guys doomsayers, what's really kind of creepy is what everybody consumes as the mainstream stuff is clearly the cheerleading crowd. We cover that a lot on this show, where we'll dissect an article that comes out on something or news that comes out relating to something and realize, you know, they've totally focused on this, which is maybe the absolute best spin you can put on something, but it sure isn't the truth. So hopefully by looking at these two extremes, we can come up with some good info. And there are a number of articles today, kind of all on the same subject, and that's how I'm justifying covering them all in the same show. We'll see how long it takes to get through these. But I think it's important information, and the ones we're going to cover primarily are from Zero Hedge. We've got one from that really caught my eye was the Housing 2006 Redux, Mortgage Fraud and Speculation Come Roaring Back. And really, all of these, the thread that sort of weaves through all of these is a trend in which we are seeing things that remind us of what led up to 2005, 2006. And, you know, yesterday's show, the day before, I think a show we did a week ago, you know, we've talked about different charts, different data that really remind me of the lead up to the downturn in 2005-2006. And that should scare the crap out of anybody. That's, as I've – the same analogy I've used before, that's like being Leonardo DiCaprio on the bow of the ship just as the iceberg is coming, right? Nothing you can do about it. You can't turn this thing fast enough to change anything at this point, but you can see it coming. Right. And we're seeing the same – we're seeing the equivalent of that iceberg, and it should be something that everyone's concerned about and okay, or at least be knowledgeable of. Right. Maybe it doesn't concern you. Maybe it doesn't have to scare you, but it absolutely should inform decisions that you're making today to try to prepare and be ready for whatever bad thing might come. So the first one I want to hit here is the article from Zero Hedge on – sort of we're replaying 2005-2006. And he's got an interesting little preface at the beginning, and I'm going to read that one, that part in its entirety, but I'm going to only take bits and pieces from what he has to say in these follow-up articles or follow-up paragraphs. To preface this report, I consider the subject matter and my findings herein to be as important to contemporary housing and residential credit forecasting as my early work in 2005-2006 on Bubble 1.0. These data go a long way in identifying the missing energy link driving what I have coined a demandless house price surge and explaining what the recurring annual rate plunges to historic lows, institutional speculators tripping all over themselves for sub 3% cap rates on single-family rental houses, boomerang buyers, boomers longing for vacation condos on beaches, and a deluge of foreign demand with H-1B and EB-5 visas can't. And this one's kind of interesting, and it kind of spun my gears a little bit simply because I just acquired a property using this method, right? I purchased a home as a second home, based on the idea that when I vacation, I will go there. And then once everything's set and done, put the gears in motion to rent it during the times I don't plan to use it, to turn it into a income-generating property. And in that news – and this is something we'll probably cover in a different show. I've decided that for the vacation rental stuff, I'm going to do specific shows on it, on topics relating to it. And the next one will be on getting it rented. And I'm happy to tell everybody that within 24 hours of kicking my marketing into high gear – I'm not even sure I want to call it high gear, medium gear. I've already gotten two folks who've come in to rent the property for a week each. So that's good news. The place really only needs to rent about 50% of each month in order for it to be positive cash flow. So that is awesomeness for me. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. We'll talk about what I did. And you know what's interesting is I did that – well, again, I should do this on a different show. So look for a show coming up on what I did and the way I did it, I discovered what really works and what doesn't really work. So we'll talk about that in a future show. But anyway, let's get back to this because we have limited time. He bottoms lines it by saying the second vacation home demand has surged more than any other housing segment over the past 3 years. Now, I would argue – because, and the reason why I went sideways here into my vacation thing is because he seems to characterize this as an actual vacation home purchase. He goes on to say the overwhelming market opinion is that aging, equity market affluent baby boomers are all rushing in at the same time to buy their dream vacation home. But this is misguided as the data herein reveal the truth. There is no indication true second vacation home demand is surging at all. And I think it's important to agree with this, to be dubious about the conclusion of many of the mainstream folks that this is aging equity market affluent folks going out and buying a vacation home. I would suspect that more of them are like me, that because of the way these mortgages are set up, the interest rate that you're going to get on a vacation home is ridiculously good. I got a better rate on my purchase of a vacation home in Hawaii than I got on my primary residence. Right. Now, granted, these two loans were about 8 months apart, but interest rates hadn't really changed that much. They'd gone up point something, 0.01 or 0.02. But even when I look at them and I look at the trends of the markets between the two, if I had gotten a vacation home loan at the same time or didn't get my home loan and got a vacation rental, it still looks like I would have gotten a better rate by by 0.01. So the bottom line is that people are going to jump through a lot of hoops to get the better rate. If it means getting a vacation rental loan that's officially labeled as that in order to do so, I think you're skewing your data based on and see, this is one thing I love about when they crunch this data. Whenever you see something like the vacation rental thing, everyone just assumes that means everyone's going out and buying vacation homes. Oh, great. That must be a sign of this, this, and this because they're buying vacation homes. My suspicion is that that is not what is happening, that a vast majority of those folks are doing other things. Maybe they're vying for a position for it to be an actual investment property. But because the type of person who's going to go out and buy an investment property also shops for the best possible deal on financing, they're going to go ahead and some are going to maybe claim incorrectly that they're ever going to live in that property, but then they're going to rent it. Now, in my case, I'm a little anal retentive about that kind of thing. So if I say I'm going to use that as a vacation property, I'm going to use it as a vacation property. But that sure isn't going to stop me from renting it during the time I'm not there so that I can be in compliance with the spirit in which I acquired the loan. Right? And I would encourage all of you to be in compliance with the spirit in which you acquired the loan. Because if someone comes asking later, you need to be able to back that up. And I'll be able to do that. I mean, who wouldn't want to go to Hawaii as often as they freaking can, right? So the record will accurately show that I'm over there at least two or three times a year vacationing in my vacation property. And the fact that other people are there when I'm not is not the core thing. All right. Anyway, sorry. In fact, going back to the article now, the data fully supports his thesis that this housing market is spun out of control from rampant speculation, process incompetence, relationship-driven dissonance, and outright fraud, or an exact repeat of 2005 to 2007. Fraud and lending occurs late, mid to late cycle when demand is stalling and can't get a boost organically or fundamentally, is simply another form of stimulus and transitory by nature. It's not durable. In fact, it's like stimulus. Pervasive fraud leads to a slingshot effect when the drivers suddenly turn countercycle on some sort of catalyst. Excessive speculation and fraud are driving house demand and certainly prices. So this is one that I find interesting to hang demand and prices on speculation. I'm not real sure that's 100% true. I think that what we may be in is a full-blown frenzy, at least in the local marketplace. So, but here's an interesting note. So I have an investor client who's interested in purchasing any multiple unit property. So like a duplex or a quad, commonly called a fourplex as well. So she's definitely in an investment mindset. She wants to live in one of them, and then rent out the other or others. So she and I have been, and right now she's currently my only active investor client who's out looking at properties, and I'm daily reviewing her results, and which is kind of pointless to do it daily because those flip properties just don't come on the market every day. But reviewing her results and checking out what happens, and we're looking to find something for her that'll fit. What we have noticed, and this is particularly interesting because it's an investor client, we tend to see things maybe a little quicker or a little sooner. It's like it's a leading indicator of what things tend to bleed down into the main market. When we first started looking about 6 months ago, it was nuts. I mean, stuff was selling within a day or two. The amount of interest for each property was ridiculous. But we're not seeing that anymore. Now, we're only in August, so we can't make the argument that it's just the seasonal time for that to happen. The season of buying is right up until the end of August, and bleeds even a little bit into September, but it might tend to slow down in the last couple of weeks in August. But over the last few weeks, we've seen this trend, and it feels a lot like a wall. We're seeing properties that we're looking at where the price is being reduced. We just had a price reduction of $20,000 on a property that we looked at a couple of weeks ago, and the agent reached out to let us know that he was going to do that. That's an interesting thing because this property is in San Jose. This is not Gilroy. This is not San Martin. This is not Morgan Hill. It's not some outlying community. This is a property in the heart – well, not in the heart, in the lung – of Silicon. Well, it's in the heart of Silicon Valley, but in terms of being within like at ground zero, it's not quite ground zero of where all this tech stuff is. It's in sort of it's not even really south. You know what? I think I could make an argument that that sucker's in the heart of San Jose. It's not downtown, but I mean it's in an area where you wouldn't expect this to be happening. So it just struck me as odd that he's having to do this. Now, it is a condo setup, so it is the properties we've talked about here are the first ones where you will start to see this. It was not a duplex or a quad. It was just a condo, a single condo. But it's super interesting that we're seeing this happen. Now, remember, we've talked about this particular type of property, condominiums, being a leading indicator of what's bleeding down. It tends to be the first ones to get the negative effects of a market that's changing. And to see somebody with a property in this area of such high demand having to lower their price indicates to me that we might be seeing just the very first indications of something like what he's talking about here in this article. Let's see. Both appraisal and occupancy fraud are primary features to a speculative house price bubble. Okay. I don't buy the appraisal fraud stuff. Let's go ahead and talk in detail about what he thinks this is. Now, pervasive occupancy fraud and lending purposely misidentifying investment properties as a second vacation for the purposes of obtaining prime, owner-occupied, low-down payment mortgage versus expensive investment property loans. That, I would argue, is absolutely happening. And we just talked about that. Low down payment is back in a big way in driving housing demand based on National Association of Realtors 2015 Investment and Vacation Home Buyer Survey. It comes on the heels of a multi-year cycle of increasingly bad appraisals, a widespread problem by the appraisal management companies that in Bubble 2.0 are similarly conflicted as independent residential appraisers were during Bubble 1.0. I'm going to argue that it's totally a systemic thing. This is not fraud in terms of appraisals. So I think his argument on the appraisal side is absolutely wrong. In fact, we've argued here that we're not seeing appraisals coming in at purchase price simply because this market has increased so much that it's the appraisals are actually undercutting the sales price because they don't have enough data to support this higher price based on most recent sales because prices have gone up so quickly in such a short period of time. So I'm not seeing what he's seeing in terms of appraisal fraud. I think these purchases are still happening. I think folks are, again, in a fever, and they will find, as we discussed the other day, they are figuring out ways to get beyond the appraisal problem when it comes to low appraisals. Does fraud happen in appraisals? Absolutely. Fraud happens in everything, but it's not going to be happening in a statistically significant level to actually push what he's talking about in terms of causing a downturn. And I would argue that his claim that it's what fueled the 2005-2006 downturn is also incorrect. I don't believe that to be true. I think they were simply basing it on what had sold and once enough – and that creep up had happened over such a slightly longer period of time that they actually had data to say, well, someone just bought a house just like this one for the same amount of money 2 months ago, and there was data to back it up. So, and being a guy who I wasn't there from 2005 to 2007, but leading up to that, I mean, when I was doing market analysis to figure out what we should sell a house for, there was plenty of evidence in the form of other sold homes to back up those numbers. So I honestly don't think that has anything to do with it. But the question of whether or not there's fraud relating to folks saying they will be in the house or using the house as a vacation rental and then never actually living in it and just using it as an investment loan. Of course, I believe that's absolutely happening. And why is that absolutely happening? Because there's this weird dynamic where for an investment property, you supposedly should have to pay more interest. We could have a bigger discussion about that. I think it's one of the stupidest things I've ever heard. I don't know why you want to discourage people from doing this kind of stuff, particularly if they have a credit history and background to back up making the loan. Whether they're going to use it to live in that house or rent it, frankly, shouldn't matter much. Maybe it should if it's their first time renting a property. Maybe the world needs to understand that person A does not suck at renting a property, and they And so if I'm an investor, if I own a property and I'm renting it and it's positive cash flow, and I go to get a loan on another investment property, why in the world should I have to pay more for that loan than I do for my primary residence? It doesn't make any sense, frankly. So that's a whole other show. All right. Now, he goes on to say that this is an identical replay of 2005 to 2007 that nobody recognizes, expects, or is even looking for, which will present an opportunity at some point. Now, so the reason why no one is recognizing part of this is because it's not happening. The appraisal part ain't happening. Goes on to say process incompetence, willful blindness, relationship-driven dissonance, and outright fraud are late, mid to late cycle features of this housing market normalizing, defined by me as end users retaking the mix and needing ever more creative financing in order to purchase houses at extreme valuations, and a stiff headwind to volume and prices when a catalyst suddenly turns these drivers from pro to counter-cyclical. All right, so he seems to be throwing a lot of magic words at us to want to confuse the situation a little bit, but let's get into it here. The reason why he shouldn't be looking at appraisals as to why home values are going up. Or getting extreme valuations. They're getting extreme valuations because in the months leading up to that purchase, other people bought similar properties at higher prices. That's what the problem is. The problem isn't what the appraisal guy is doing. The problem is the appraisal guy is seeing examples of homes selling for that amount over the last 3 months. That's the period of time in which they work. The problem is buyers who are willing to pay these higher prices. That's what it's always been about. That's what it was about last time, and that's what it's about this time. It's like war games. You know, the only way to win is not to play. And I realize that's not a good proposition for a lot of folks who are looking for a place to live, who want to stabilize their housing costs. But if buyers simply won't buy at a certain price, then it won't sell, right? Because that's what puts a stake in the ground and says a property like this is worth this is when someone buys it for that. What's interesting about a market like mine is that I'm seeing, you know, it used to be much more common, but I'm seeing folks who are putting down a lot more than the normal amount, that being anywhere from 10 to 20%. So it's almost like a lot of folks are going in realizing that they may have to make up for a appraisal that doesn't come in. So and in realtors I talk to, when a house doesn't appraise, by and large, the folks doing the buying figure out a way to come up with additional money, or they work out some sort of a deal with the seller. So it seems like it's something that's not stopping the process of the purchase. Let's see. Occupancy fraud and contemporary lending is back with a vengeance and driving house purchase demand, a late cycle condition. This follows his December 12th report on appraisal fraud running wild. Again, I would argue that it's not running wild, that it's simply reflecting that people are paying more. So, but that's one of his points that he's trying to support here on the whole bubble idea. Now, vacation sales surged to historical highs of 1.13 million, slightly greater than bubble 1.0, as quote unquote investment property demand wanes. This represents 21% of all houses sold in the U.S., a whopper 57% year-over-year increase, and a mind-warping 140% surge since 2011. And this is so easy to understand. I don't get it. I mean, investors are going to look for the best place to go to get their money. Now, when I was talking – because I'm not someone who ever wants to have a situation where some official who wants to put me in jail or take my money have concerns about the terms under which I bought a loan, right? So I asked ahead of time, what's the criteria? How many times do I have to use a vacation property per year in order for it to be pretty understood that it's a vacation property, despite the fact that when I'm not there, I rent it, right? So, I don't think they gave me a number, but I said, you know, I plan on going over there 3 times a year. Is that enough? I mean, that's my vacation house. That's my definition of a vacation, and is doing that, and everyone involved absolutely said, yeah, that would absolutely fit the bill. The problem comes in when folks buy an investment property and then never see the inside of it again. What they're saying here is that someone buys it as a vacation rental and then turns around and as a vacation home, and then turns around and lets someone sign a 2-year lease, and of course they're never back inside the property. Now that's fraud. You know, I suppose if there was a certain amount of time between when you purchased it and when you decided to change your tactics and rent it, that would be reasonable. But I have a feeling in most cases that's not happening. So this is simply a case of investors going where they can get the best bang for the buck in terms of buying their investment property. These numbers are pretty staggering, and I think absolutely reflect that, right? When you get – what did he put here? What did we see? We had a 21% of all houses sold in the U.S. were of the vacation financing type, a 50% year-on-year increase, and a mind-warping 140% surge since 2011. And when you look – if you were to chart that with investment purchases during the same time, you're going to see a direct correlation between a decline in investment purchases and an increase in vacation home purchases simply because it became less it became less efficient to purchase as an investment. So people doing what will get them the best deal should surprise no one. Second, vacation home sales growth of 21%, 57%, and 140% over the past 3 years has never been rivaled at any time in housing market history and represents the largest bubble 2.0 gains by any order of magnitude of any housing market segment. Of this specific growth channel, I estimate that a minimum of 33% was based on fraud and never should have occurred. But it's all the same trade, a late cycle phenomenon, only by different cohorts. Yeah, and then he does what I just said he should do, and he created a chart that shows vacation properties versus investment properties. And right around 2011, you start to see the vacation properties jump and the investment properties drop. And really, all that is it is a statistic that simply doesn't reflect the reality, right? And how many times does that happen in life? You're still seeing a dramatic increase. You're still seeing what's really funny is the vacation line almost becomes the trend line for investment properties. You can see in January 2010 a big jump in investment properties all the way through to 2011, January of 2011. And then at almost the exact same spot where that stops and starts to go down, the vacation property line goes up at almost the same rate. You could almost just overlay them and have them just be the same color, and it would show investment demand. So it shows increasing investment demand right up to today. So then the argument becomes, you know, we've talked about how there's been a huge drop in investor purchases in the marketplace and how that indicates deals aren't there to be taken. And, you know, I've based that on all cash purchases, right? Because all cash, I think, is a more honest reflection of that. I don't really look at whether or not it was an investment loan or a vacation loan or anything else when I'm analyzing that data. So, you know, you can take that for sort of what it's worth. But this is just switching one for the other. So are there still investors out there? Absolutely. They're simply using a loan that has a different name. And I'm sure that the slope of this line, some percentage of those are actual, real, honest-to-gosh vacation purchases. And probably – he's probably correct. Probably 30%, 30 to 40% are fraudulent. And if you were to take out that 30 to 40%, this line would absolutely match with the investor line completely. He goes on to say vacation purchases made up a record 21% of all U.S. new and resale purchases in 2014, while investment fell to 19%, still a very high number historically, yet less than vacation homes, which has never happened before. Let's see. And then another cute little table. Combined vacation and investment properties made up 40% of all U.S. home sales in 2014, a speculative frenzy only seen one time before in 2006. Now, this is where it really gets interesting because I honestly believe that his combining of these two numbers is a good thing, but B, needs to be dropped by the amount he indicates, even in his own data, that it of what those vacation loans are probably actually not fraudulent, which in his case would be 30%. But even then, that still leaves us at a point higher than anything since 2005. It was 40% in 2005. With his numbers, it's 40% in 2014. It would be slightly less than that. It wouldn't be quite 40%. It would be about 35 to 40%. I think it would be in the high, probably closer to 40% than the 35%. But the last time we saw a point like this was in 2011 at about 37.5%, 38%. And frankly, all of the stuff in this range is concerning. Because it so closely mirrors what we had when things went bad before. But that shouldn't be taken all by itself. All cash purchases and vacation and investment homes has plunged over the past 2 years. All cash purchases of vacation and investment homes has plunged over the past 2 years, a key feature of pervasive occupancy fraud, also present in Bubble 1.0. So, you know, his claim on fraud is, you know, he's just basically trying to lay the bricks for that. The median distance to vacation homes from the buyer's primary residence plunged from 435 miles to 200 miles over the past 3 years. That's an interesting statistic. In 2006, the distance was 215 miles away, down from nearly 400 3 years prior. Now, that one I think is actually a huge indicator. You know, my vacation home is thousands of miles away. So see, here I am, I'm also in the back of my head trying to build my argument if someone ever comes and accuses me of doing this fraudulent thing that he's indicating. And then that creeps me out too, right? It pushes the idea that this is really setting the stage for a similar situation that we had back in 2005, 2006. His next point, house prices plunged in 2014. The median vacation home price was $150,000, down 11.1% from $168,700 in 2013. This while all other home prices rose 5% nationally to 2014. The laughable excuse for the 2014 house price plunge by NAR's Lawrence Yun, as we all know, one of my favorite people. Yun explained the decrease in vacation and investment sales price is likely due to the increase in vacation and investment buyers purchasing condos and townhomes. Additionally, the rise in vacation buyers purchasing distressed properties and buying in the South, where home prices are often lower, contributed to the overall decline in the sales price. It could also be folks buying out partners in a property, right, based on their loan. The laughably eerily similar excuse for the 2006 house price plunge by NRA's David Lira. The drop in investment prices comes as no surprise, but for vacation home prices to edge down in a record market is a bit puzzling. It may result from a large dumping of inventory on the market by speculators, especially in the condo sector, with long-term second home buyers taking advantage of the glut and buying at negotiated discounts. This underscores that housing should always be viewed as a long-term investment, providing solid returns over time. Anecdotally, part of the drop in the median investment price results from investors shifting away from pricier markets like Florida, Nevada, Arizona, and into affordable locations New Mexico, Idaho, Utah, Georgia, Tennessee, and the Carolinas. U.S. home prices versus vacation investment prices, just showing which way they were going. U.S. home prices were going up, vacation home prices going down, and investment home prices mirroring them going down as well. The 16% price delta between the plunge on vacation home prices and 5% rise in all others is not explained by condos, as national condo volume fell 2% and prices were up 4%. Buyer age of vacation houses has plunged and converged with the age of investment buyers as volume surged, just like in Bubble 2.0. This is a strong indication of occupancy fraud. Armies of baby boomers retiring and buying their dream condos would push average age higher, not lower. This sets the lenders up for putbacks, realtors up for lawsuits, and borrowers up for federal bank and wire fraud charges if, in fact, this was the plan from the time they obtained the loan. Lastly, this is not durable demand. Now, these are all things that I think absolutely are true and fit exactly in with what we've been talking about here. And the other thing that I think is interesting is it so puts into focus the contradiction of what folks have been saying about what the market's been doing. You know, and it's clearly an idea of where the shift has simply happened in terms of folks needing to get their funds from somewhere for their investment properties, and they're getting desperate for them. So let's see. What's his next thing? Vacation demand surges and buyer age drops, just like in Bubble 1.0. And the chart for that one is ridiculous. Vacation property sales goes up. Vacation property buyer age of vacation homes drops from just under 50 to just over 40, where at its peak, and it did the exact same thing. So back in 2005, it was up around 55 and dropped to a low where vacation – this is kind of funny because the peak and the lowest point of these two graphs are at the same point. So in other words, the peak of vacation sales was in 2006 with property values of just over a million. The bottom of buyer age for vacation homes was just above 40 at the exact same time. And we're seeing the exact same thing happening here. So, you know, that covers the fraud thing in terms of what we're seeing. I don't think there's a lot to argue with there. I mean, he makes a point about appraisals that I disagree with, but I don't even think that's the convincing part of his argument. He really focuses on the fraud element or the direction that investors went or the lengths folks went to make these purchases that set up kind of a bad situation last time and demonstrates they're happening now. Now, the next one is about twin trillion-dollar bubbles. Now, this one's really – what was most sexy about this particular article was the statistics. So I want to run through these because it's about debt. It's about overall debt. We talked about HELOCs in a show a week or two ago. Let's talk just about debt in general because that's also a thing that feeds into this, right? The average loan term for new cars is now 67 months. That's a record. The average loan term for used cars is now 62 months. That's a record. Loans with terms from 74 to 84 months made up 30% of all new vehicle financing. That's a record. Loans with terms of 74 to 84 months made up 16% of all used vehicle financing. That's a record. The average amount financed for a new vehicle was $28,711. That's a record. The average payment for a new vehicle was $488 a month. That's a record. The percentage of all new vehicles financed accounted for by leases was 31.46%, a record. Now, you know, and that's all interesting stuff. It's a debt thing. It's a what we pay per month thing. But let's try to see the other side of the coin of this data. Now, the first three or four of them scare the crap out of me, that people are extending their indebtedness over a longer period of time. That is bad. That's not a good thing. It's bad. It's not good. So those are numbers I can't argue with. There's no flip side to that. Extending it long, unless they're getting what I would like to know is what are the interest rates associated with those? I'd want anyone that's getting a 0% interest rate, I'd want that just removed. Anyone who doesn't get a 0% loan for as long as they possibly can, doesn't know how to play this game. So I know the last two cars I bought that were brand new, I got with 0% financing from Ford, and I waited for Ford to have another 0% financing thing just so I could take advantage of it. But I don't recall – I always recall that 0% financing thing being one of the shorter-term options. You couldn't go for these – I've never even – geez, I don't think I've ever even bought a car with a 67-month payment to pay it back or term to pay it back. But that's scary if you're paying an interest rate. The next ones, well, kind of the average amount financed, the average payment, the average percentage of all new vehicles financed accounting by for leases. That last one maybe is a little concerning. But those two, you know, everything is increasing in cost. The value of the dollar in your pocket is going down. What things – inflation is happening. It would seem to me that the powers of inflation alone would make these true, where the average payment and the average amount financed go up to the point where it's a record. So I'm not sure how crazy I'd get about that or worry about that, but these other ones, that's a little bit concerning. It absolutely speaks to the debt issue. U.S. households' non-mortgage debt is soaring is the point he's trying to make here. And I'm quoting, what we've found is that mortgage holders today are carrying more non-mortgage debt than at any point in the past 10 years with an average of $25,000 per borrower. That's $1,400 more on average than 1 year ago and nearly $2,600 more than in 2011. The primary driver of this increase is a rise in auto-related debt, which accounted for 81% of the overall non-mortgage debt increase over the past 4 years. Now, he doesn't mention it. I'm not real sure why, but The corollary to that would be what we talked about relating to HELOCs a couple of weeks ago, where HELOC debt is just gone crazy. And all of these HELOC loans that are now maturing to the point where they're going to convert from an interest-only payment style to a fully amortized loan is raising everybody's payments and is going to cause problems there, right? Here are some key things he puts at the end of this that are also kind of interesting. Black Knight found that U.S. mortgage holders are carrying the most non-mortgage debt they have, an average of a – okay, we just said that. Student loan debt among mortgage holders is at an all-time high. Among mortgage holders, student loan debt has increased by roughly 56% since 2006 to an average balance of nearly $35,000. The share of borrowers carrying student loan debt has increased by 44% in that same time span. 48% of mortgage holders have automobile debt as well. Yeah. I would argue that that's probably been true forever. Auto debt accounted for 81% of the – I'm actually surprised that number's not higher. Yeah. Yeah. Most folks I know who have a mortgage have a buy a new car every few years. Once they pay one off, they keep it for maybe a year and then maybe buy another one. Auto debt accounted for 81% of the increase in overall non-mortgage debt mortgage holders over the past 4 years. Nearly 15% of those with homes in the lowest 20% of values are still underwater compared to just 1.7% of those in the top 20%. Some 5.7 million borrowers lack enough equity in their homes to cover the cost to sell them. So here's another flavor here. Here's another way to look at this. We are not fully out of what we were already in, right? So even if we're in the general neighborhood of the bad things that were going on then and heading towards a potentially second downturn, it could be immensely worse because we have so much shorter distances to fall before things are bad for people, right? We've already got a certain percentage of folks who are in trouble. We've always had people that are in trouble to one degree or another. We always will. But it seems to me that in some marketplaces – there's some marketplaces here that are ridiculous, that are right back up to where they were 2004, 2005 in terms of high prices. But that's very select areas where I think craziness is going on, and I think folks who are buying at those highs are going to be disappointed eventually. But other areas like Morgan Hill, San Martin, Gilroy aren't that. At that level, there are still plenty of folks who are not seeing their home values up to what they were before the downturn. So that just is another indicator of if this is starting to happen again, we have so much less cushion between where we are and really bad stuff, given all the debt and given the fact that we haven't recovered enough from the last time, that I think it could be a lot more painful. All right. Let's see. And I wanted to give you this one. This one's really just like the warning signs. So we'll finish off with this. These are basically headlines. So there's lookout number one. Shell slashes 6,500 jobs and spending on prolonged downturn. Royal Dutch Shell reported its quarterly results last week, $3.4 billion down from $5.1 billion for the same quarter a year ago, and warned that today's oil price downturn could last for several years. Number two, UPS is a very good barometer of the consumer end of our economy. It's the largest component of the Dow Jones transportation average, both by sales and market valuation. And the headline is, UPS fires warning shots across the bow of the stock market and the Fed. UPS isn't very confident about the U.S. economy. This is from MarketWatch. Here's what UPS CEO David Abney said in a recent conference call with analysts. If you just look at it, in January, the GDP forecast we thought was going to be about 3.1. Now the thinking in July is about 2.3, so let's say a pretty significant decrease. Number three, Rolls-Royce may be best known for its luxury limousines, but the heart of its business is making engines for jet planes. Along with General Electric, the company dominates the aerospace engine business. Rolls-Royce issues fourth profit warning in less than 18 months. Business isn't so good. Rolls-Royce just issued its fourth profit warning in the last year and a half and is shutting down its $1.56 billion share buyback introduced a year ago to conserve cash. The problem, weak demand for its jet engines. Lookout number four. IATA air freight market continues downtrend. The International Air Transportation Association report that air freight load factors have dropped to lows not seen since 2009. The expansion in volumes we saw in 2014 has ground to a halt and load factors are falling. Lookout number five, idle container ship fleet expands for second straight month. The number of idle ships over 520-foot equivalent units has jumped from 82 to 108. Business is so bad that owners of 108 ships don't have any business whatsoever. The traditional peak summer season has so far failed to provide a boost to vessel demand, as the weak cargo outlook is forcing carriers to cut back on their capacity deployment plans, reported Alphaliner, a container shipping watchdog. Number six, the reason why all these transportation companies are struggling is that global trade is – simply shrinking. They have a chart up here, Merchandise World Trade Monitor by volume, down from 139 to 135. World trade is falling at the fastest pace we've seen since the last financial crisis. Again, you put this into context, this is a lot of the crazy stuff that we saw last time. Global trade shrank 1.2% in May from the previous month, and the little followed World Trade Index, which tracks import and export volume, fell to 135. Bashing of the transportation industry is just as much of a warning about the overall economy as transportation stocks. Do you have a contingency plan to protect your portfolio when things turn ugly? So, you know, I wanted to roll all of those into one big ball of fear that we could all either just push deep down inside and try to ignore, or try to blend it with what we've been learning about what's going on in the real estate markets and what our practical experience is and what we're talking about here on this show, and decide whether or not we need to start making some plans on how to manage things that might go sideways coming up. So there you go. I know it's – I'm not sure what to name this. I'm not sure if I want to do it every Wednesday, where we just sort of go down and just beat ourselves over the head with the 2x4 of economic woe that folks are slinging around out there. And then maybe follow it up with Happy Day Thursday, where we just talk about headlines or news items that tend to stress how wonderful everything is. Would that be good? Do you want the good first or the good news first or the bad news first? Maybe that's the way we should do it. I love to wrap these things up with, here's what you should do as a buyer, seller, and investor, you know, and I guess just given this general news, if you don't currently have absolute control over what your housing costs are, if you're renting, stop renting. You should buy something. Get something that will freeze your housing costs. And I realize that can be a difficult proposition in some markets, particularly the ones I serve. To be fair, I've been saying this for 6 years. So it's one of those costs. If you can get it frozen, freeze it, because I'm not real sure that we're out of these woods yet. If you'd like to get in contact with me, there are a variety of ways to do that, but the easiest is www.therebelbroker.com. You can also head on over to www.soldbyrobert.com. If you're interested in renting a fabulous vacation rental in Punalu, Hawaii, on the island of Oahu, head on over to robertsrentals.us. That's robertsrentals.us. Take a look. Plenty of photos up there to give you an idea of what you're getting into. And I can pretty much guarantee you it's the best rate in the area for such a property. Just hands down. It'll be great. You'll love it. It's fantastic. Anyway, thanks again for listening, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.